Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a Phoenix photographer's subversive takes on some of the classics.
And why tourism in the San Francisco Peaks has proven controversial over the years.
But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The Board of Supervisors has a non-discretionary duty to canvass. That is the law in Arizona, regardless of what some people think. So we've spelled it out.
Tucson needs and deserves clear and enforceable guardrails to provide the greatest protection to our residents and our environment when it comes to data centers.
My solution is go back to the what we used to do, which is if you have more than 9 unexcused absences in a semester, you flunk the course.
I don't think that rises to the level of doxing. Having personally experienced my kids' information being posted online and having them deal with the consequences of that, I don't think this is the same thing.
Last year, I had a patient who had to stop a cancer treatment medication because she lost her insurance for 3 months and couldn't afford her medication during that time.
And joining me to talk about a debate over whether a state lawmaker is doxing ICE agents, more disputes between the Maricopa County Recorder and supervisors, and more are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Matt, let me start with you on Senate President Warren Peterson. He's asking the U.S. Attorney for Arizona to look into one of his Democratic colleagues, State Senator Annalise Ortiz. She was reposting some social media posts about where ICE agents were located, courthouses, things like that, during the time that they were picking up migrants and starting deportation proceedings. He is accusing her of doxing them, of breaking other various laws. She is saying this is no different than using Waze to alert other drivers a speed trap is on the way. I'm curious how you see this.
Well, I think we've seen in multiple jurisdictions around the country instances of people posting, as she did, where ICE activities are ongoing. I haven't seen any of those successfully prosecuted as doxing or interfering with a federal operation or anything else. So that'll be interesting to see going forward. I think the bigger thing for me is the notion, as she referred to these ICE agents as, I think, masked thugs or some term like that. I just think that is unfortunate. And it is similar to back in the 90s when it was the far right that would refer to federal agents as jackbooted thugs, which was also wrong. And so I just think it's unfortunate that that's the level of the discourse, and that's how we're referring to folks that are, you know, carrying out very difficult operations and putting themselves in harm's way in a lot of cases.
Tony, do you see this as a case of doxing?
No, it's not. It's not a case of doxing. This is protected by the First Amendment. The ASU clinic on the First Amendment said, no, she's within her rights. And aside from all this, and plus, you know, Warren Peterson wrote the doxing law, or at least he sponsored it. And maybe the reason why he referred this to the feds, because he knows it doesn't actually fit into what doxing is in the state. But, you know, this is specifically, she posted on Instagram that there was ICE activity and an address. That's it. That's all she posted. I've heard people, you know, it's not doxing or illegal or dangerous when the radio points out that there's police activity in a particular area. It's the exact same thing. And I think that, like, to be really clear about this, as we're getting into sort of the legal nuance of everything, this is an elementary school where this activity was happening. This is an elementary school where, you know, immigration enforcement was happening. And I don't think that is the kind of thing that Americans want to happen right now. And I think that tensions are really high because of the escalation and the sort of what I think are really dangerous tactics that have been utilized in this enforcement. I mean, people are like, oh, she's putting people in danger by doing this. When I hear that, I think, one, we know that didn't happen. We know that no one was injured. Nothing like that happened. Like, we know that. And the second thing is like, if there's potential for danger, why are they going into an elementary school without notifying the school, without doing any of those kind of things? Like, I think a lot of this is theater. I think that Peterson has been criticized for not being MAGA enough. And there were some radio hosts and some activists and people who were urging him to do something. And I think that's the reason why he did what he did. And I think that that part is really unfortunate, too.
Matt, let me ask you about something Tony just brought up, in the sense that tensions are very high. This was obviously something President Trump campaigned on doing. A lot of his voters want him to be doing this. You mentioned some of the rhetoric that critics are using. There's also obviously like a lot of fear and concern in certain communities, in immigrant communities and migrant communities about, you know, people who are both non-citizens and citizens have been swept up in some of these sweeps. Is there a way at this point, do you think, to bring that tension down at all? Or is this just kind of where we're at for now?
Oh, I think this is where we're at for now. And just to be clear, like, I don't believe the federal agents entered the elementary school. As I understand it, the operation was in the vicinity of the school. There's been, you know, reporting that it was some distance from the gate of the school, but I haven't seen anything to suggest they went onto school property. But that aside, emotions are running very high on both sides. And, again, these ICE agents are carrying out the job they've been instructed to do. I think we all have an interest to make sure that these agents are safe. And certainly we want to make sure also that the general public is kept safe. So, you know, this is obviously a very difficult situation on both sides.
Matt, how big of an issue? Obviously, we're a very long way away from elections next year, although people are obviously running and talking about it. How big of an issue would you expect immigration to be, maybe on both sides, both for the right and the left?
Well, I think it's going to be a big issue because it's Arizona and it's always a big issue here. What is interesting is that the number of illegal crossings has fallen to such a level. I mean, when was the last time you saw a press conference at the border with, you know, an elected official or, you know, media down? I mean, there's just nothing to see right now. And so in some ways that may actually boomerang against the Republican candidates simply because Trump has made this virtually a non-issue at the border itself.
Tony, what do you think? Big issue for both the Democrats and the Republicans?
Yeah, I think that like in the past when we've talked about immigration, people were thinking about the border. And then a lot of like people who were sort of like speaking out in favor of immigrants were thinking more about enforcement and individual lives and people. And one of the things that has happened because of the way that they're doing this enforcement is the public is opening their eyes to an element of this immigration fight that they necessarily weren't paying as much attention to before. And one of the things that I've already started to see in like public opinion research that's done internal and that kind of stuff is that there is a backlash among voters right now in Arizona and America to the way that this has been happening.
Mostly Democratic voters?
No, this is something that's pretty across the board. And so, you know, obviously Republicans are going to be more supportive of the president. But even then, you'll hear people do, you know, they'll add caveats saying like, well, they need to only be going after violent criminals. But I saw that they were, you know, at Home Depot, or I heard that they were, you know, going to courts or schools or whatever. And so I do think that there is a big backlash. And one of the things I'm keeping an eye on is that it seems that most of the Republican officials that are really like doubling down on this, I don't think that they're aware that that's something that's happening. And I think that that could end up hurting them electorally.
Well, Matt, you mentioned the fact that the border being as quiet as it is could potentially in some way hurt Republicans. Do you buy into what Tony's saying, that the way that these immigration raids, the mass deportation that so many voters voted for is going, do you think that could potentially hurt Republicans, or do you think that maybe helps Republicans?
No, of course the way that the operations are carried out matters. I think what voters support is going after criminal aliens, mm-hmm. and going after people with violent records. And to the extent that they're doing that, that's going to be popular with 80% of the public. But if you're, you know, going into other populations, people that have been here for, you know, decades and don't have a criminal record and things of that sort, or let's say scooping up people who may not even be in the country illegally or have some sort of a visa to be here and sending them to, you know, a dark site in a foreign country, like that those kind of things, even if they happen very rarely, impact public opinion in a bad way.
All right, guys, let's move on to the what is the ongoing saga between the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and County Recorder Justin Heap. The lone Democrat on the board, Steve Gallardo, has filed a complaint with the Attorney General over open meeting violations for the recorder, Justin Heap. He, of course, the very short version of the background is he is trying to get support for the agreement between the supervisors and the recorder over who does what with elections, and was saying that he had Gallardo's vote, trying to get other, at least two other supervisors to side with him so that he could have the majority. Tony Gallardo is now saying that if he's trying to cajole votes out of public meetings and texting with others, that's a real problem. In addition to what Gallardo is saying, that Heap is lying about the fact that Gallardo was supporting him.
Yeah, he clearly was lying about the support, which is just weird. But it's also it seems to be the kind of thing that Heap and the folks that run his office are doing. You know, Arizona has very sort of clear and strict open meeting laws. And I imagine a lot of the listeners don't really know what they are. But basically, it says that if you're going to be operating the business of government, you know, as a deliberative body, like a board or a city council, it should be done in front of the public. And so what that means is that behind the scenes, you might imagine that elected officials are sitting down and plotting how they're going to vote, but they're really not supposed to. It's supposed to be that deliberation is happening in front of the people. And that's why things have to be on the agenda, all that kind of stuff. And so what Gallardo is saying, basically based on the texts that that Heap himself sent, is that he's not doing that. He's going and he's talking to individual members and counting votes and doing these kinds of things. And so, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that that's probably what he's doing. You know, enforcement of open meeting laws is something that is often challenging because there are very important law enforcement activity, you know, like, you know, other things to work on. But I think that when it comes to sort of like the total lack of trust that the Republican, conservative Republican Board of Supervisors has with the Republican recorder, you know, I think that that's a thing to keep an eye on.
Matt, you and I have both spent a lot of time outside closed doors at the state capitol waiting for lawmakers who are getting their arms twisted to vote on certain things to come out. I mean, to Tony's point, this is something that happens a lot. Lawmakers, policymakers, elected officials trying to secure votes, not
well,
in front
state,
of the public.
The legislature has a different set of laws than these types of boards.
That is true. But like, I mean, does this seem problematic that he's texting other elected officials trying to get them on his side?
That's hard to say. And once you begin, let's say the AG takes this up and begins an investigation, nobody knows which way that goes. And, you know, frankly, if she starts poking around and, you know, the other text messages that the recorder is sending, you know, who knows what else is in there. So I think for me, the bigger issue is like this is just the latest in a string of mishaps for Recorder Heap. I mean, you know, don't forget his plan to send mail-in ballots to voters that weren't on the mail-in list.
Yeah.
Sending, 83,000 voters before the election a notice that they had to do something to ensure they were actually eligible to vote.
And then telling the public that there was a problem with that, right? Like he hid that problem. That was a big deal.
Yeah. And basically, you know, foisting that off on a third party vendor. So it's just, again, the latest in a string of problems with the recorder and his administration. And we're on the eve of a big election coming up in 26 and a lot at stake.
Yeah. All right. That is Matthew Benson. I'm also with Tony Cani. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. Good morning. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Democratic strategist Tony Cani and Matthew Benson of Veritas. Tony, let me start with you on the No Labels Party, which is looking for a rebrand. This is a fairly new operation that is already looking to potentially change its name. I'm curious, like, let's assume that they're able to do it and they're able to get some candidates on the ballot in 2026. What kind of impact might a third party like that have on elections here?
Well, I think we have seen that third party candidates don't really get much support in Arizona. That's a thing. But when some of these races are very, very close, potentially it could cause, you know, a candidate who otherwise would have won to lose.
But ask Matt Samet about that, right?
Right. And one of the weird things here, too, is that like No Labels blocked people from running for Senate in the last election. The Supreme Court ruled they can't do that, blah, blah. But, you know, the person who was running was like a super MAGA person, right? And then like so it's like, who are these no labels candidates? Are they on the right? Are they on the left? Are they in the middle? I don't know. But I think that like when it comes down to it, this, I don't think this is a super serious operation. It seems like it's just like a public relations push to try and get the failed, you know, top two initiative that the voters rejected last time, you know, pushed through, right, to sort of change the way our elections are done. But yeah, I think this is a little frustrating. I think it's a little bit silly. But yeah.
Matt, do you think there's a possibility of spoiler candidates or maybe even a no labels or whatever they're called next candidate actually getting elected to something?
Well, first, kudos to you for a reference to a 23-year-old gubernatorial race.
Yeah, you like that?
Matt
yeah.
Salmon.
Thank you.
There were like six listeners that were all nodding along with that. So
it's public radio. There's like 10 listeners who got that
yeah,
one, right?
Yeah, that was good. Oh, no, of course, like Arizona is a very close state. Elections are determined on the margins. A spoiler, like a no labels can play a spoiler role. They're not going to win, but they could play a spoiler role. Mm-hmm. Every little bit matters in races that are determined by, I mean, the attorney general's race last time around was like
280 votes.
200 something votes. Yeah.
There you go. So, yes.
Do you see this sort of in the same vein as like the Libertarian Party, the Green Party, like candidates that get maybe 1-2%, but in some of those close races can really make a difference?
100%.
Is that how you see it, Tony?
Yeah, I do see it. I mean, of course, it's still up to the campaigns and the candidates to try and earn the support of the
sure.
voters who are choosing to go to the, you know, to this third party. But yeah, it definitely could make an impact.
So no Ross Perot's coming out of this, you don't think?
I can't imagine that somebody would get that in more than 2 or 3%.
I said that just to go a little bit further back in time for you, Matt. I hope
yeah.
you appreciate that.
No, I like it.
All right, let's talk about some people who actually we know are going to be running for office. We see that in the 4th congressional district, that's Greg Stanton's district, Dr. Zudi Jasser is making another run. He ran last year. Also, a former state representative, Eric Descheny, will be challenging Jonathan Nez in the 2nd congressional district Democratic primary. That's Eli Crane's district in northern Arizona. Tony, do you see – I'm curious, like one of these you have the attempt at least for a rematch. We don't know if Jasser will get a primary challenge or not, but the attempt for a rematch. And in the other one with Descheny trying to prevent a rematch between Nez and Eli Crane.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's an interesting – primary. I don't know how it'll shake up. I think that it's an uphill battle for both of those campaigns that are facing the incumbent. You know, I think that Greg Stanton's in a really strong position, and I think that in the first district, it's possible that a Democrat can win for sure. But I think it'll be a challenge. But we're a year away from the primaries, and this stuff's already happening. Like this is, you know, we're just in that perpetual campaign cycle now, where there just is no downtime.
I'm curious, like, is it possible to look broadly at the idea of rematches? You know, we're seeing this in David Schweikert's district, where two of the candidates who ran in the Democratic primary last time are running again. Or is it so candidate specific, district specific, maybe even cycle specific, that it's not really possible to tell whether or not a rematch will be successful where maybe in the past it wasn't?
Well, I mean, I think that with population changes in the state and with everything, each race is its own unique race. But what happens is if they have spent a bunch of money in the previous campaign, you are basically saying, okay, you chose not to vote for me last time, but you should change your mind and vote for me this time, which sometimes can be a challenge if there isn't some feeling of regret that the voters have about the person that they've put into office. And so that's one of the things that needs to happen. And, you know, particularly like the Schweikert race is like, how are they going to convince voters like, hey, actually, like you made a mistake. And so I think that's what when I'm looking at a candidate that I want to support, I want someone who I think can make that argument effectively.
Matt, let me ask you about Zudi Jasser first going up against Greg Stanton. That is nominally a competitive district, but Stanton has typically won it fairly easily over the years.
Yeah, that district has performed more progressive than it would appear on paper, and it has kind of trended increasingly that way. Bigger picture, we used to say all politics is local, right? That was the axiom.
Mm-hmm.
That has really turned on its head in the last 10 years, and now all politics is national. So these races are really our partisan divide. Everything has become nationalized. I would argue that these districts, especially your swing districts, are determined more by what's happening at a federal level. Like if the temperature, what is the temperature regarding Donald Trump? If he is super, super unpopular, coming into the midterms, then, you know, these kind of competitive districts, then, you know, you could see Republicans all over the country get swept out of office. But if Trump is actually like pretty popular, kind of around 50%, 48%, 52%, then you're going to see, you know, Congressman Schweikert and Ciscomani and other folks like that have no issue. And really, I think it's more about the national temperature than it is these individual races and the candidates.
I guess the one thing we know for sure, at least I think we know for sure in Arizona, is that the congressional districts that we have now will be in place next year as opposed to some other states, right?
I mean, it looks that way, but I think Arizona is not going to redistrict before the next, certainly not in the next
few months or something.
Yeah.
Tony, I'm curious about the Democratic primary up in the CD2 in the Eli Crane district. You have two members of the Navajo Nation. Both have been elected to things. Jonathan Nez was the Navajo Nation president. Dis Cheney was a former state rep. It's not necessarily a primary that's going to get a ton of attention, and Nez was the nominee last year. I'm curious, at least at this very early stage, how you see that one shaping up.
I think it's going to be likely a pretty intense campaign. You know, it might not hit our airwaves or anything like this, but I imagine that the campaigning is going to be pretty robust between those candidates. I think that Nez is a really popular guy up there. I think he probably, I haven't seen any polling, probably is the favorite still. But we'll see how that plays out over the next year.
Matt, in a district like that, is it safe to say that Donald Trump would have to be really, really unpopular for someone like Eli Crane to truly be in trouble?
Really, really, really unpopular. I mean, Eli Crane is going to be very difficult to take out of that district.
Regardless of who the Democratic nominee is?
Regardless.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Matthew Benson, Tony Conde, thanks to you both for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the history of tourism in northern Arizona and the sometimes controversial draw of the San Francisco Peaks.
But first, picture this. Botticelli's Birth of Venus, but instead of the goddess rising out of a seashell in the ocean, it's a plastic shell in a Phoenix backyard. Venus is a queer woman who's tattooed and wearing stilettos. The blanket her angel is throwing over her is a serape. That's what the iconic work looks like through the eyes of Phoenix photographer and artist Omar Soto. It's part of their recent exhibition, Mediums of Hope, that's showing now at the Phoenix Art Museum as part of their Emerging Artist Awards. Other photographs in the series include Soto's interpretation of the Archangel Michael defeating Satan. Michael is draped in a Mexican flag. And a gender-bending Venus of Urbino. It's just the kind of subversive subject matter that Soto, who is non-binary, likes to feature in their work. But it's mostly meant to be uplifting. I sat down with Soto in our studios recently to talk more about how a high school photography class turned into a career and why they treat digital photography like the film they learned first.
I still have my film camera. I love it. And I kind of treat digital like it's film. You know, I and that's why I do everything practical, because I want to be able to capture everything in camera and have like the most minimal of any type of editing as possible.
Right. So you're shooting digital photography, but
yes,
almost treating it like film, because
exactly,
the scenes that you set up are what you see in the photo. Like you said, you maybe will erase like a line of a string or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
But for the most part, what you're shooting is what you're getting. Talk a little bit about just the process, the setup that might go into something like this, because these are intricately costumed. There's lots of props.
Yeah.
There's bubbles in one of these photos.
Yeah.
How do you do this?
You know what? I guess it really starts with research, of course, looking into these paintings and these iconic images that we grew up with. You know, the Venus I'd seen everywhere. There's religious iconography that I grew up with, you know, growing up as a Catholic. And, you know, I'll research the artist. I'll see what their lives were about, what they're about, you know, what their issues were. You know, I just really like to deep dive. And if the image just kind of calls to me, then I'll look up the context of the painting as well. And, you know, there's so many little details that go into them, and it reflects when they lived. And yeah, you know what? Then I start doing kind of some soul searching, I guess. I start looking into my own life and how I could relate to this, or people that I know and how I would think that they could relate to it. And then I start thinking about setting where I could have it at. And I guess I kind of like the limitations of the real world, like, because it kind of pushes you to, like, innovate and try new things.
So you're not recreating these in studios that look just like the originals, right? Like,
no.
The Birth of Venus painting, you're doing a photo of that painting, and it's in, like, it looks like a backyard. There's a cinder block wall, right?
Yeah, it was definitely my friend's grandma's backyard.
There you go.
So shout out to her.
Talk about that photo in particular, based on the famous painting, right? Because it's a great example of what you do. You can tell immediately what it is that you're doing and what the image is supposed to reflect.
Yeah.
But it's very subversive. You're using queer models, lots of people of color.
Yes.
Why?
You know what? Because I am both queer and a person of color, and I'm an immigrant. And the theme of the series is, you know, these mediums of hope, you know, and what I mean by that is that there's different mediums that have been used throughout just history, you know, like the caveman scratching onto the wall or just painting, and then photography came along. And, you know, we all kind of project our hopes and dreams onto these images. Even when you're religious, you do, you know, you pray directly to the photo of the Virgen. Mm-hmm. And I do end up casting people of color because of the fact that, you know, we looked at these images and they were so iconic, but they were never created by us or for us. You know, they're usually very straight and very white. Mm-hmm. And even when you're Mexican and growing up Catholic, you know, there's all this imagery of people that don't necessarily reflect your life. And I really wanted that for ourselves. I wanted to reclaim it. I wanted to show that, you know, we have power to just look really resilient in these images. And, you know, the settings are always really based in places that I grew up.
Hmm.
Space is really important. You know, it can limit you depending on where you grew up, or it can help you excel. And these spaces aren't always seen as beautiful. But I wanted to show that even in a place like this, you could still thrive, you could still chase your dreams, that you could really make things happen for yourself. Mm. And that's why I wanted to create it. I wanted to have community and to show us and center us, basically.
Right, because it's a commentary in itself, right?
Yes.
Like the painter or the photographer putting a subject in the center of the painting.
Yeah.
That's what beauty is, right? Like
exactly.
That's what you're saying with that, right?
Yeah.
So you're recentering who is considered beautiful.
Exactly. And it's almost like I'm not asking, I'm just taking it for my own, and we're just going to rock out like that.
Let me ask you about your own identity and how that plays into this. You identify as non-binary.
Yes.
Has that always been the case for you?
It was always a feeling that I had that, you know, I never felt completely comfortable as male, but I also didn't feel completely comfortable as woman, because I don't really see myself as either. And I guess the way that a religious person could say that, you know, you're a spirit having a human experience, I guess I kind of see it in that way, because I never worry about gender, really, you know, in respects to everybody and what they identify as. You know, I just feel like I'm just me. I'm just Omar. And non-binary kind of fits that. And, you know, growing up as an immigrant, I had a immigrant upbringing and community, but the thing is, they didn't really see me as one of them either. So it's like when we were being shunned by all these different laws and stuff like SB 1070 and, you know, things that would push a community together, I also felt very outed from that community. So I felt really isolated.
So that's interesting, because you're saying you felt othered and then othered again, right?
So
is that what you're trying to remedy here by kind of creating or celebrating this community that probably feels the same way?
Yeah, it literally is. And it's even me putting myself into it. And in these images, you know, they're searching for hope and a better day. And, you know, I just feel like if you just try, at least, I just want to know that I tried, you know. So yes, I would say that I do this for those that have felt othered and for myself. And it's kind of a healing process. It's very cathartic, I guess, to be able to put my hopes and dreams into these images and make my own reality, I guess. And honestly, it's manifested into my own reality. So yeah, it's really cool.
Manifested into your own reality. That's
yeah.
Lovely. Let me ask you lastly about reaction to this, right? Like, I mean, do you get pushback? Are people offended by this sometimes? Because you'll do lots of, as you mentioned, like Catholic religious imagery, but in this kind of subversive way.
Yes.
What do people say?
Well, you know what? Yes, it's definitely a varied reaction. You know, especially when I was first starting with the series and I was looking for locations, you know, I wanted to use locations that were, I guess, iconic in, to me in places I grew up. And, you know, either people really like it or they really hate it. And, you know, and I mean, I'm cool with the discourse, but, you know, sometimes people feel like, yeah, it's disrespectful, but then I guess I have to question, well, why would it be disrespectful that a queer person or a Black person is centered in that image? You know, and it's not really even a commentary on religion. It's just about the symbolism of religion and how we put our hopes and dreams into that. And I just wanted that symbolism for myself and for the series. Honestly, the discourse is kind of it's kind of cool that people have that, because, you know, I guess that means that it's thought-provoking enough without disrespecting anybody. I just wanted to center, you know, brown and queer and Black people.
Okay. We'll leave it there. That is Omar Soto joining us, photographer and recipient of the 2024 Sally and Richard Lehman Emerging Artist Award from the Phoenix Art Museum. Omar, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
And now for the latest essay in our Soapbox series on the theme of misbehaving. Phoenix storyteller and teacher Carly Davis explores the difference between being bad and being authentic.
When I thought about having kids, I was sure I'd have girls. I'm a girl. My sister is a girl. That's what I knew. I imagined raising little feminists, tiny Gloria Steinems who'd stand up for themselves and their friends and go out and change the world. But I have three boys. And what I've learned is I can still raise feminists. But those little adjustments we make as parents with our expectations, they're not always just reframing. Sometimes they take more care, more effort, and sometimes they require help from experts and specialists. Imagine the Be Kind rally at my son's school. I wasn't there, but I heard all about it. The whole school was packed into the auditorium. I can hear the squeaky cafeteria chairs. I can see the really enthusiastic young people on stage, clapping, singing, handing out stickers and friendship bracelets. And my 7-year-old, he stood up from his chair, turned to face the audience, raised both arms, and flipped off the entire auditorium, double middle fingers. I got a text from the teacher, then a call from the teacher, then a call from the principal. By the time I got to the principal's office, I was ready to take the heat. I was mortified. When she said, "We just don't know where he could have learned that. No one at this school uses the middle finger." "Right, lady," I confessed. "He probably learned it from me. I flip off the speed cameras on the way to school. I'll stop. I'm sorry." Then there was that time at the lake. The kids were picking up crawdads and making fishing poles out of seagrass and sticks. But my kiddo wasn't with the others. I finally spotted him, slowly rising from underwater, his little white baby chest covered in algae and muck. He looked like a swamp monster. It was funny once, but he kept doing it alone. That family over there started looking at him sideways, and I felt it again, embarrassment. The last time I was in the principal's office, I sat across from her and a team of specialists. They shared their diagnosis. His brain is wired differently. He doesn't always get social cues, but he's highly empathetic. He prefers to talk to adults and often thinks he is smarter than most of them. And that quirkiness was just part of it, too. I cried with relief when I got home, not because it changed him, but because it changed me. I finally understood, and I stopped feeling like I needed to apologize for him. He didn't need fixing. He was fine. Actually, he inspires me. When he's had enough of a social interaction, he leaves in the fastest way he knows how. Middle fingers, swamp monster. But doing so, he reminds me to check in with myself, to say no when I need to, and to take breaks. When he spends hours reading chemistry textbooks and tells me every fact about plutonium, he reminds me to dig into what I love. When he refuses to fake a smile just to make others comfortable, he pushes me to be more authentic. When I stand up for him, he learns to stand up for himself. And he might still change the world just by being himself.
That was Carly Davis. You can hear more Soapbox essays and learn how to tell your own at kjzz.org. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Controversy has surrounded the San Francisco peaks near Flagstaff for several years. Most recently, the debate centered on treated wastewater being used by the Arizona Snowbowl Ski Resort. The peaks are considered sacred by a number of Native American tribes. My next guest has researched the history of the peaks and the controversies that have come up related to them over the past several decades. William Holly is an historian of the American West and specializes in the San Francisco Peaks and Flagstaff. His work, called The Mountain Is Part of Us, Tourism, Community, and American Indian Sacred Land in Northern Arizona since 1969, is the winner of an award given out by Brigham Young University. I spoke earlier with Holly, and we started with the fact that for a lot of people, the idea of tourism and development in Arizona centers on the Phoenix area, but that northern Arizona has had a pretty interesting history in terms of preserving the past, trying to bring more people in, and marketing itself to the wider world.
Absolutely. You know, the interesting thing about that is the history of tourism in northern Arizona is much more extensive and, you know, it's been around longer than tourism in the Phoenix area, for example. You know, that goes all the way back to the Santa Fe Railroad being built across northern Arizona in the 1880s, long before Paradise Valley or Scottsdale ever were thought of in anybody's wildest dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of that tourism has been geared towards even since the railroads, not just the natural wonders. Of course, everybody knows the Grand Canyon, but the human wonders. And what I mean by this is the gateway to what we call Indian country.
Well, so what's the balance between trying to market especially Indian country with keeping the people who live there, you know, maybe sort of doing right by them and making sure you're not bringing people to their communities that maybe they don't want there?
You know, and that's something that I wrestle with my work, with the writing I'm doing, the research I'm doing on a regular basis, because we see multiple instances of, and especially surrounding the San Francisco Peaks, what we're talking about today, of the tourism industry. Historian Hal Rothman termed it in one of his works, the growth coalition. So I use that term quite a bit. Wanting to grow tourism, bring people in. It's good for the economy. It's good for everybody. But oftentimes that everybody, and even in some of the things they say in the hearings that have to go about this and publications, interesting side note, the Flagstaff Chamber of Commerce up until the 1970s had a publication that they gave to retailers in the community called Their People Too. And it was all about how to deal with Indian customers because they are people. They're not us, but they are people. And this balance, it often forgets that those people are there until they get loud enough to be force the Growth Coalition to hear them.
Well, and one of the areas that you spend a lot of time studying about is the San Francisco Peaks, which, of course, in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about snow bowl and what kind of snow, you know, and water used to make that snow should be used on the peaks. But as you've been writing, this is a controversy. This area has been kind of controversial in the tourism and growth area for a lot longer than just snow bowl.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Flagstaff entered the tourism age relatively quickly after its founding, with the 1926 building of the Route 66 and, of course, the railroad. And almost instantly, they found themselves straddling this line where they were holding the Flagstaff All-Indian Powwow starting in the late 1920s, inviting these people in. We want the Indians here. We want the native people here. We want them to do their dances, and we want them dressed to the nines, that kind of a thing. Yet the participants were segregated in an Indian village. The participants weren't welcome to stay around after the powwow. And this kept going on and on. And of course, the snowball, though, is really, ever since it was built in 1937, the snowball has really been this driver of tension within the Flagstaff tourism industry, not just with Native American peoples, but with environmentalists, with people who felt that maybe skiing was, and it prior to World War II, it definitely was skiing as a rich person's sport, and everybody else is getting left out.
Within the community, how do all of those various interests not align, but like how do they work together, or maybe how much conflict are they in even now? I mean, some of these seem like very much at odds competing interests.
Yeah. And you know, one of the interesting things that I found in my work is it depends on what we're talking about. And there's limits I have found. There's limits in the community. And let's say this, but let's exclude the American Indian community from this for a moment. Let's just talk about in Flagstaff, the predominantly Anglo community for a moment. There are limits. So, for example, in 1969, a man named Bruce Ledbetter from Flagstaff, he had experience building ski resorts in Colorado, Steamboat Springs, Aspen area. And being from Flagstaff, he decided, you know, there's this Park Prairie at the base of the Peaks, perfect area for a resort village on the scale of like an Aspen or a Vail or a Steamboat Springs. Now, this caused a lot of problems. This is what we call the Hart Prairie controversy when we're talking about conflict in Flagstaff over the peaks. And you saw a lot of the Anglo residents, environmentalists, business owners, students, professors, all walks of life in Flagstaff, and this has, you know, late 60s into the mid 70s, stand up and say, this is too far. Now, bringing back in the American Indian perspective, none of these are okay for them. And so from their perspective, it has to be very difficult to find allies, alliances that could be feeling where it could stick and it could be a good alliance for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. And I see strange bedfellows and people who at one time were yelling at each other in public hearings, 2 years later are working together, and everybody just kind of flip-flops.
Well, so how do those sort of shifting alliances, what kind of impact does that have on how the peaks are handled and what kind of projects are allowed and maybe even how, you know, people in the community, both indigenous and otherwise, feel about this?
That's a really interesting question because, you know, in the first, I would say, 15 years or so from 1969 into 1983, which covers like the first two major conflicts regarding the snowball and the peaks, and where American Indian peoples especially had a large voice, it worked okay because there was a key landowner who was also involved and had money to spare, if we will, and help with lawsuits that perhaps may have been more difficult to have done if it was just the tribe standing alone. You know, fast forward 20, 25 years, we get to the wastewater. Tribal nations are much more stable now. They have more sovereignty. There's a lot more federal laws in place regarding how sacred sites can be used, what can be used, things of that nature. So when we get to the wastewater, the tribal nations, they went alone. They didn't wait for anybody in the community to say, hey, we're going to stand up with you. They went on it by themselves. And I think just looking at some of the things I've read about that and some of the things that I lived in Flagstaff during part of that time. So I remember some of that. It created some tensions that maybe had started to dissipate in Flagstaff and then it just kind of erupted them again. This is real legitimate issues to people who have a claim on this peak, this mountain, from long before any of us ever got here.
William Holly is an historian of the American West, specifically Northern Era's San Francisco Peaks. He's teaching at the University of Idaho.
Well, Mark, from Grumpy Cat to Lil Bub to an endless stream of super shareable cat videos, felines have long dominated internet culture. But did you know you can feed your obsession with an annual event that takes the phenomenon to the next level? The silver screen.
Indeed, Cat Video Fest has been curated exclusively by Will Braden since 2016. He says he watches around 15,000 cat videos to prepare the annual 75-minute presentation. It'll play in movie theaters around the country. Get this, his business card says simply, I watch cat videos.
And a lot of them, it seems like. All right. So Cat Video Fest is playing a few select theaters around town through next Wednesday, so you can check it out. A portion of ticket sales will benefit animal-related nonprofits. And you can find showtimes and more at catvideofest.com. You know, Mark, I did get to meet Grumpy Cat once.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Was he or she grumpy?
Yes, and tinier than I thought. Oh. Adorable.
Oh. Were you allowed to pet Grumpy Cat? Is that a thing?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh.
Super sweet cat.
Okay.
Actually, nice, but grumpy.
Oh, okay. I mean, I can't imagine why they'd be grumpy. It's so much fame and publicity, right?
I guess you're right. But, you know, fame is tough.
That is true. I'll never know. All right. That'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Have a terrific weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.